Welcome to Crypto Nights, where we help you finally make sense of the trending world of cryptocurrencies. So gather your virtual piggy bank and let's get started.
Hi, James. How are you?
How are you?
Fantastic. James, I'm very, very excited to have you on the Crypto Nights podcast. I wanted to kick it off by having you just talk to me a little bit about your past, what you have done. Introduce yourself to our audience. How about that?
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm James Sowers, and I'm an ICO advisor and also was a lucky person to be an early participant in some of the crowd sales that happened before the boom started, before they actually started calling them ICOs. I'm also an angel investor, too.
Okay, angel
investor. In a number of startups.
You're one of the few people that admits that you're a lucky early starter. Many of them are extremely... they might have been lucky to get in early, but they don't admit it. They always attribute it to some prescient or some kind of a prognostic, some kind of a deep vision that they had about how they should get into this domain. But it's refreshing to see someone like you that is authentic and says, hey, I was one of those lucky early adopters of crypto. So how did that happen? Can you tell us a little bit about your backstory? How did you get into it? Who told you about it? And what was your first investment?
Well, I remember hearing about crypto before I got in, many years before I even got in on it, because I heard about Bitcoin actually on CNBC. Someone had just mentioned as a currency, it was one of the currencies that appreciated the most, you know, more than the yen, or depreciated the way the yen was, and euro or whatever. And I was like, Bitcoin, what's that? I couldn't even pronounce it right. And it was really hard to get any information. This was like around early 2009, so I couldn't participate because I didn't really understand it. And any information you could get, there was all this stuff with the wallets and the characters. I was like, man, this is either like totally a scam or it's so complicated, I would mess it up. Mm-hmm. And then right around in 2013, there was an exchange called Coinsetter out of New York that ended up getting bought by Kraken. I think it was because of the bit license in New York. I'm not 100% sure why they ended up selling them to them, but I have a feeling that was the thing. And in 2013, on CoinShares, when I first got into Bitcoin, just luckily.
Wow. And which year was that?
2013.
My goodness. How much was Bitcoin at that time?
Well, it was a variety of prices. I mean, it was all over the place. At some point, I think it went pretty high. But when I got in, it was in the 70s, between 70 and 100. Now, the reason I say between 70 and 100, that's another thing I always say, too. People who say, like, oh, I got in Bitcoin exactly at 77. That early, really, because when you go in to buy it, like $1,000 worth, the liquidity was so low and it was so hard to understand even how to use that exchange, you got filled in a number of prices. So you got some at one price, some at another. So I'm saying the average price was around like in the high 70s because some of it was more, some of it was less.
And did you hold
on? I had fractions that were in a hunt that were, fractions of it were like $100, fractions of it were like $73, fractions were $77. So it wasn't like all, you know, at one price.
And did you hold on to them or did you turn around and sell them when it was 200 or something like that?
No, that's another way I got lucky. Because what happened was is I kind of just left it be for a while because I was thinking, yeah, we'll see how this thing turns out. And then I remember one day getting an email, something about a Kraken or something, and I thought it was some kind of scam. And I just kind of ignored it. And then one day I remember hearing Bitcoin was up high and I went to go to log in and it took me to this thing Kraken and I couldn't really understand what the hell was going on. And then one day I realized, that's right, one day I got an email from Kraken saying that they had changed over or something like that, or to onboard yourself. So then I went to onboard myself and I was like, okay, so that was CoinSetter and it was still there. So at that point it had already fallen back down because I think it went up to, I don't know the exact prices offhand, but I think it went up to like 1200 or something running into that Mt. Gox fiasco. And it fell all the way back down to like the 200s or 300s. And at that point I was just like, I'll just hold on and see what happens. So I just got lucky because if I would have had a chance to easily go on and sell at 1200, I probably would have did.
Wow, that's fantastic. Congratulations, very exciting.
Thanks.
Now, can you tell me how you progressed after that? How many investments did you make? How did you get into ICOs? What has your journey been? What are the lessons learned? That kind of stuff.
It was kind of funny too, because I started hearing about Ethereum. And I remember that they had a crowd sale. I imagine it was around 2014 in June or July. I don't know the exact date. And I remember they raised all this Bitcoin to fund their project, but I didn't really understand how to get into that either because all that thing with the wallets, it was kind of hazy. So I kept thinking about that and listening about that. And then eventually you know, Ethereum got on Coinbase, so it was easy to buy it because I trusted Coinbase because it was United States. I was kind of like fearful of anything that wasn't in the United States because from the Forex days, when I used to be involved in Forex, I had learned that any overseas exchange, it was like you could get your money in, but you might not get it out. So I was kind of had the same fear with this. And I just happened to get lucky because when I think it's pronounced Quantum, but I call it Qtum because of Q-T-U-M. When they did their ICO, I was like, oh, this reminds me of Ethereum. There's more information now on how to do it, how to transfer to a wallet, send from a wallet to the crowd sale. They still call them crowd sales. And so I'm just going to do it because I've been lucky. Ethereum has started to go up a little bit, and I'm going to try that. So I tried that. So that was just luck in the right place. And there was also OMG, Omis Go. I was lucky in that. And then from there, I just kept getting into crowd sales. And I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting. And then all these exchanges started popping up that I'd never even heard of. And you saw coin market cap, all these coins just started showing up. And the next thing you know, on paper, they were all going up in value.
Wow. Crazy. So all in all, how many cryptos do you think you invested in?
All in all, well, I call it participating because it's a utility token. It's not really investing. It's the security tokens that are coming out now is I would consider more investing.
Okay.
So a little bit over 50.
Oh my goodness. And that was over what time frame? Couple of years?
Really from like mostly in 2017 until now.
Okay. So what was your strategy? Can you start sharing about, you know, what were the lessons learned? What were the mistakes you made? How did you improve your strategy? And now, you know, kind of, I want to see if you can make your hindsight a foresight for our audiences, because they're, who is not interested in making money in the ICOs these days? You know what I'm saying?
Right. I think initially my strategy was kind of just the way Bitcoin had taken off in Ethereum. I figured starting with, you know, the Quantum, that's kind of similar. They're building their own blockchain. But at the time, Quantum was originally an ERC-20 token only. Not too long ago, they actually did a one-for-one switch because they built their own blockchain or at least started on it now. And people are actually doing ICOs on there. But that was kind of just theoretical. I thought, you know, Bitcoin seemed to be doing okay. Ethereum seems to be doing okay. So Qtum to me was like the next Ethereum and the next Bitcoin, which hasn't really played out yet. But in return from when you participate in the ICO, you know, it actually was pretty good. The thing that's hard that a lot of people don't realize when you get in is a lot of these too, getting out is hard because you have to upload them to an exchange to sell. And then you have to change into other cryptos and send it back to a wallet. And then to Coinbase or someplace where you can get the cash if you wanted to liquidate. Also during the process too, I've lost a lot of coins, even participating in ICOs where I'll do a test to see if it works. And it either works or doesn't. And sometimes a smaller one works, but the larger one doesn't. And also going to an exchange or coming back, I've lost coins also. I know a number of people that have claimed they had Bitcoin in the beginning when they didn't really understand it and they can't even find their Bitcoin. So those are probably the honest people. They were actually in earlier to me, but they just couldn't figure out how to get it out. I've also lost keys too from some of the early ICOs or crowd sales I participated in where I can't even access the coins because I was stupid and lost the keys. I think there's three risks going forward, though. One is you have the risk that the people who do the ICO never can complete the project because it's so ambitious that they either don't raise enough money or the technology isn't there. Another one is that it's just like any other startup, it just fails because the founders of the team wasn't capable. And the third risk is kind of the risk of you losing the coins yourself or even exchange your wallet risk. I think something could happen with these wallets one day. It's just like I think one of the wallets now is doing a fork. And I remember initially one of my concerns was the security with all this. And people said, oh, you're crazy. That can't happen in blockchain. I have a feeling there's a lot of things that can happen in blockchain that they said can't.
Wow, that's fantastic. I like the way you summarize those three risks, you know. So the companies that were too ambitious, companies that just couldn't execute, and then losing your wallet, the private keys, so that you cannot get back into it, or you're losing the keys during the transmission of your coins between wallets, etc. So I think those are all very good pieces of advice. But now let's come to what were some of your biggest successes, and were they pure luck, or did you actually select them very carefully and you had some strategy behind and you picked something and they worked out very well for you?
I think a lot of it's just pure luck. going backwards. In the future, I think the whole landscape of ICO is actually going to change. A lot of people are going to change the name to token generation event, which people are already trying to do. Because ICO is a misleading term. Kind of sounds like IPO.
Okay. So everything around it was supposed to be, it was almost like trying to be cute and fool the SEC into thinking this is not a security token. I mean, just because you call something a token instead of share doesn't mean the SEC will automatically assume it is not a share. Come on. That's, when you look back, it's kind of dumb, you know. And the same thing with ICO. It's trying to be cute and say initial coin offering rather than initial public offering. I agree with you that token sale is definitely a better one. But given SEC stand, you know, what we heard Jay Clayton say, he is basically saying that any token, including the utility token, could be considered as a security if it is marketed that way.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a case-by-case thing. If somebody has an existing blockchain, an existing business already, and then they use a token that benefits the community and the users, the developers, things like that, that might be a true utility. But people who are doing it just to raise money because ICO is hot, then that's you know, almost probably definitely a security. Of course, you know, I'm not a securities lawyer or anything like that or SEC person, but it just seems like it would be that way.
Yeah, good disclaimer to put in. And I want to add in another disclaimer that just because you and I are talking about making money in ICOs doesn't mean we are recommending ICOs to anybody. I think it's one of the riskiest instruments out there. You know, among the traditional investments, stocks and bonds have always been considered to be extremely risky. And in my opinion, cryptos are even more risky, the tokens, than even stock market. So, you know, kind of invest at your own risk type of thing.
Yeah, I think too that the whole spirit of blockchain being open source and crowd sales were like, with Quantum, is people believe in a project, so they are participating to help the project almost as a participant. So it's almost even like a donation to further the project, and there really shouldn't be any expectation of it being valuable in the future. Nobody knows.
Okay. and James, are you full-time investor into ICOs, or do you run a, are you doing a regular job daytime, and this is
no, I don't do a regular job. I'm really like a full-time angel investor and advisor to companies.
Can you talk about that a little bit? You know, what do you mean angel investor? Are you talking about traditional equity type investments?
Traditional equity type investment.
Okay. So how long have you been an angel investor?
Well, for full time, really, since last December till now.
Okay.
I'd made one or two previous, but I wouldn't really even call them angel investing. It was just kind of like making the investment for, those were lucky too, but that's a whole other story. I also got lucky in a stock years ago, but a lot of stuff in this kind of stuff is luck. Being in the right place at the right time, because it has to be the right time for something.
Yeah, well, but in some sense it's luck and some sense not luck. Luck in the sense you couldn't tell whether they'll succeed or not, but you kept on shooting. In some sense you had a bunch of darts and you're throwing them. Sooner or later you would hit a bullseye. So you are working your probabilities also in some sense. Yeah, it is luck, but the luck couldn't have favored you until you were participating in the market. That's my opinion.
Right. In angel investing, I kind of like to bet on the founders, because I always have a saying a lot of people don't really like, but you know, the good investors works for the founders. The bad investors thinks the founders works for them. So I try to invest in founders that, you know, I want to work for a number of years for free, because you're basically working for them for free. If you invest in a company you want to see, you try to help them with your network in any way you can.
I know that some of these might be confidential type of investments, but are there investments that you made that you're able to talk about? What are your more successful investments and how did you select them?
In the angel investing, it's kind of hard to know what's going to be a success into the future, because you know these investments are so young from December till now, but you get an idea of people making progress. Like you can see the progress they're making. Like I actually invested in a company, ShareShare, that went through 500 startups and the Y Combinator grant program that they had before they ended it. And those guys are doing pretty good. They're kind of relentless. It's an app where if you cut hair and you own a barbershop, you have empty chairs. And a lot of people don't even know this problem exists. So the salon owner, for lack of a better term, rents out the space, and somebody can go on the app that cuts hair and find it, and the salon owner fills the chair. And they've also added back end stuff where a lot of those guys, because they're independent contractors, you know, they need help with doing their 1099s or whatever they do.
How do they fill the chairs that are empty?
Because people go to the app and if, say, if you're in Texas, for instance, and there's a barbershop nearby, you can find a local barbershop that needs chairs filled, and someone who needs clients, they go there and they rent the chair. So it's basically like, if I'm a hair cutting person, I don't know the proper terms in that field, but if I'm a stylist and I need to help somebody, you know, cut hair, I go there and I pay for the chair from the salon owner. So salon owner gets rents out the chair. I guess it's almost kind of like a retailer renting out space, but it's a salon owner renting out his space, and a chair is considered a space.
I see. And what is the space used for? Is it still used for hair cutting or something else?
Hair cutting.
Okay. So it's almost, you're almost Uberizing or Airbnb-ing the empty chairs.
Right.
Got it.
And the founder, the one guy, Ty Codwell, he's like a celebrity in that space. He even wrote a book and everything, and he's like a PhD in whatever the field that's called, the barbers do.
Got it. Very interesting. Okay, so that's, and what is the full name?
Share. Like cutting hair. So Share Share. Yeah, another one too is a company on Forte Fit. They're out of New York, and they're like the Netflix for exercise, where you stream different classes, and there's a teacher that could be anywhere in any city, but it could be a famous exercise teacher, and you're attending their class virtually, so you're not really there, but you're watching it on a live stream. They're doing pretty good too.
How do you come across these investments? They sound very interesting. How did you find them?
Well, ShareShare, I met them at 500 Startups Demo Day. I was actually out there. I think it was last February. I was out there at Demo Day, and Forte Fit, I actually found them because a guy named Adam Carver, he knew them.
I see. Now, on the Demo Day, there are literally tons of companies pitching. How did you pick one? That was also pretty good. How did you pick this one among so many pitches?
It's kind of, like I was saying, it goes back to the founders. So I kind of look for the founders. You have to say, is this the team to do it that's going to build this, that what they're doing? Is this, can they do it? Are they determined? Are they not going to quit? Are they relentless? So I look for that first. And then is it something someone should be building that hasn't been built yet? So with the ShareShare, you would think, oh, a haircut company and technology, what the heck, right? Because when I saw that in the the program or whatever for the demo day, I didn't even think about them. But you know, when I met the founders and saw what they were doing, and, you know, got a sense that they were dedicated to it and they really had the insight on it, that's what kind of made me choose them.
Very interesting. Okay, so so how does a typical day for an investor like you? You, to me, you're an investor. You're either investing in ICOs or you're investing in startups, right? Actually, I had another question before that. Aren't startup equity investments extremely illiquid? Why do you continue to invest in equity type of investments when you could invest in ICOs and they're highly liquid? You can get your money out anytime.
Well, I think in ICOs that may actually start changing with the securitization of tokens, where they're going to be security tokens, but that is a good point, because there is opportunity cost, and I have started to think about that a little bit, because in the beginning, when these crowd sales happened, especially in the beginning when I was participating, nobody knew that they were going to become liquid like this and end up on exchanges. And they're not as liquid as you would think, because Bitcoin and Ethereum are liquid, but a lot of the other ones aren't as liquid as you think in size. So you can sell them, but you can't necessarily sell them at the price that you see on CoinMarketCap at the time, and you have to upload 5 or 10 different exchanges in order to do it.
Just because there's not enough volume on them?
On certain ones, right.
Okay. So only the top 10?
Right, only the top ones are most liquid.
Got it. Okay, so liquidity is still a problem because of low volumes of sales transactions.
Right, none of the top five, like maybe, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, Ripple, to some extent Stellar, some extent Dash.
Got it. Awesome. And what does a typical day look for an investor like you?
Well, I'm doing a lot of advising too on ICOs and things like that. But as far as blockchain goes, I did invest in a company, Sagewise. I think you might know them. I heard they might have been on your podcast before.
Yes.
It's a smart contract resolution. So they're kind of solving a problem that nobody has really tried to tackle in blockchain. So I thought that was pretty good. And the founder is, you know, an attorney also. So she kind of understands how the legal side works.
Yeah. Amy Van and Dan Rice were both on my podcast. And so is that something you have invested in?
I did invest in them in equity.
Okay, equity. Because they're not yet, I don't think they're an ICO yet.
Not yet.
Okay, but amazing people, both of them.
Yes.
They have something phenomenal going on. And it's such a common sense oriented thing where Amy was talking about examples of, you know, contracts don't make any sense because in real life, what do you mean? You know, they have a contract to pay the rent, but they lose their job and they don't pay the rent. Contracts get violated all the time.
So, right.
So contracts should have some kind of a negotiation or, you know, challenge. You should be able to challenge a contract or negotiate a contract. And that kind of a meta level thing simply does not exist on top of smart contracts. I think that was the sense of what I remember Amy talking about. And Dan is the technology. I think he's the CTO of the company.
Correct.
Very, very smart people. Yeah.
Yeah, I spend a lot of my day too advising companies. Like I get pinged all day about stuff. I mean, I became an advisor on SafeCrypt, which is kind of a newer ICO where they're a decentralized exchange. But what they're doing is instead of having to store your coins on exchange, you can store them in your wallet. And they'll be able to be pulled from your wallet to do the trade. So you won't have to worry as much about if an exchange gets hacked. Because there seems to be a lot of problems with that lately.
Yeah, the riskiest place to leave your coins seems to be the exchange because they get hacked like crazy.
Another great thing about blockchain, I think there's going to be the birth of a lot of types of exchanges. Because I started working with eCoinmerce, and what they do is they want to be the NASDAQ for e-commerce. So basically where you can do trading of anything e-commerce, and unlike, you know, certain companies where if you're a seller, they get all your data so they can learn about you, and then they put competing products and kill you. So you're a catch-22. You want to be on that site, but then they learn so much from you in the long run, it hurts your business. So what these guys are trying to do is solve that problem to make it that through their token, anyone can join their platform, sell whatever they want to sell, and you have the rights to your own data, and nobody's trying to take over what you're doing later. So I think that's kind of interesting too.
And that's spelled what? Ecoinmerce, ECOINMERCE?
Correct.
Okay. And is that
go ahead.
Is that currently an ICO or is it over?
No, they're just starting their private sale now. So they're in private sale now. They're, you know, picking angel groups and things like that. And I think too, another great thing about blockchain going forward is a lot of blockchain for good is going to happen. Like I'm involved with one that's actually in an ICO right now, Docademic, where it's free telemedicine for individuals. They have an app and the sale is going on right now.
Docademic?
Yeah, it's MTC token.
Okay.
So that's pretty interesting stuff. But I'm thinking the future of tokenization though is going to be, as far as securities go in the United States, people are going to start tokenizing things like art, real estate, even car dealerships. Because I think that the great thing about tokens is it's going to provide liquidity for assets that aren't really liquid, where people will be able to tokenize them and even split them up, you know, into pieces basically. Possibly even someday, maybe even they can tokenize, like you said, it's illiquid for shares of startups, that somehow they could even be tokenized, like a portfolio of startups that an individual has could be tokenized.
Isn't Polymath trying to do something along those lines?
They are trying to do something like that, yes.
Okay.
With like shares of Apple and things like that.
Fantastic. Great. Are there other interesting things that you wanted to share with our audience? Maybe questions I did not think of asking?
I think too, like I've been, as director of this thing, I started a think tank, which is an LLC, Greater Good Society LLC, of starting an open blockchain initiative for good. So that kind of even leads into a little bit what we were saying about like stuff like Docademic. But what I mean by this is even like maybe governments could get involved in a positive way where tokens could be airdropped to underrepresented individuals. So what I mean by that is people who maybe have lost their jobs or just are homeless, where they can be given a chance, given tokens to like clean themselves up if they need it, you know, get medical help, even housing, like in San Francisco or somewhere where there's a lot of homeless, and the government could issue the tokens, and there could be some kind of blockchain type phone or something like that so that it wouldn't be black market trade. And they could go to a store and spend the tokens, and the store, like a 7-Eleven, would get tax credits, but the tokens could never be exchanged for fiat. That way, someone couldn't just take their tokens and trade them for fiat to do anything that's not wanted for it. And that way, everything could be tracked, too, through a blockchain ID, and you could see where initiatives were working and where they weren't, because I'm sure there's going to be unintended consequences, and improvements could be made, you know, to kind of help give everyone a level playing field, give people a hand up but not a handout. So it you know, I would actually recommend that you wouldn't force it on anyone, because I've heard people talking about forcing things on people, but actually giving them the opportunity. So if they didn't want to do it, then that's, I guess, on them. But
very good, very good, exciting. Well, what do you see as the way forward? Do you think ICOs will continue to be as crazy as they are today for the foreseeable future, or is what is your opinion?
I think in the United States, things are going to move more towards security tokens. And a lot of the utility tokens won't happen in the United States. They'll happen overseas. And actually, the United States will be left out of that. That's kind of a shame, because it hurts the whole spirit of a crowd sale.
That's what I'm thinking. Isn't that bad for the U.S. economy as a whole? Because we're going to be missing out on an entire innovation, which is huge.
I think what will happen, though, is it'll become more like startups, where only accredited investors can participate. So, for instance, like a lot of the overseas ones might do, you know, a Regulation D over here just to accredited investors, institutions only, and the regular everyday Joe won't be able to participate.
Yeah. That is too bad. In the name of sophisticated investments, sophisticated investors and accredited investors, we are trying to, in some sense, it reminds me of the cat that sat on the hot stove. After that, it did not sit on a stove at all. Whether it was hot or not, did not matter. So in this method of saying, oh, you know, people that are not accredited investors are not sophisticated. First of all, that's not logical, but we say that. And then we say, if you're not a high net worth individuals, you cannot afford the risk of these investments. But then they forgot the reward completely. And we ended up in a situation where the rich get richer and the people who are not necessarily poor but not yet accredited investors are not able to participate in those very instruments that can get them to the accredited investor level. So it's ironic.
Right. And the whole idea of a crowd sale is just for the normal guy if he wanted to put in a couple $100s. I mean, I'm not talking about like putting in a lot of his money or anything, but it's funny though, with these tokens, some of the people, if they would have put in a couple hundred, some of them in the beginning, it actually turned out to be a lot later on. I think the easy money's been made though in that way, but.
Yeah, do you think the days of easy money are over?
I do.
Uh-oh, you have to work hard for your money now. Fantastic, James. Anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think going forward, people really have to evaluate the, just like any other startup in ICO, you know, the team, can the team do it? Do they have the background to do it? Do they have the credibility to do it? And not only that, is the project that they're trying to do, can it be achieved with today's technology? Or do we need another breakthrough in order to do it? Because there's a lot of great projects out there that you really need another breakthrough in technology for them to actually be successful. Maybe we get it, maybe we don't. Now that may not be a reason not to participate, but just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I do three different things. This is Crypto Nights podcast, and I also have, I run an end-to-end ICO launch services company called SBL Switch Blockchain Labs. And then we're in the process of launching a blockchain capital, which is an investment fund with another friend of mine called Atlantis Blockchain. So, you know, so in some sense, I keep on constantly evaluating whether we are accepting a client for SBL, or we are trying to look into investments for Atlantis, or even, you know, have guest speakers for Crypto Nights. Here are the criteria. These are not necessarily sufficient criteria, but these are necessary conditions in my opinion. I look at, you know, hey, has the team, is it a solid team? Do they have an existing business? Have they been running it for a year or two? Did they raise traditional capital in the form of angel investments? Do they have a product in the market? Does it have traction in the form of users? Is it revenue generating? Heck, maybe it's even profit generating. I don't know. Is it profitable? And then finally, is there an organic need for a blockchain? And then therefore, are they raising money to scale? So I know these are extremely simple criteria, James, but I found they served me extremely well in picking some really good investments. Do they sound reasonable to you? Are there criteria that you have that you might want to add or subtract?
Yeah, sometimes even it goes on a gut feeling too, because like I had a saying one time, and someone said, "Oh, that's good. I got to write it down." So I always forget how I said it, but I said something like, "You know, talent is a target that no one else can hit. Genius is a target that no one else can see." So there is going to be somebody out there that has a really wild and crazy idea that's never built anything like that before, but they're so nuts and so relentless and so compelled to do it, they're going to do it. Mm. That's another thing I look at investing in a startup so early. Are they compelled to do it? So like another one I don't think I mentioned was Stripes. I invested in this one called Stripes, which isn't Stripe, but it's Stripes. I'm a mentored Alchemist Accelerator, and they were demo day there. And I really think they're compelled to do what they're doing. They actually have some nice partners in retail now. And, you know, is a founder compelled to do it? And just the fact that you went to another startup that didn't go so well, it doesn't necessarily disclude you, because it actually could be a good thing because you learn from that, as long as you learn from it. So I always look at it this way too. If I invest in a startup and they fail, but the founders learned and they were honest and didn't mislead investors or anything like that, well, then we just try next time. Maybe I invest in them again. Because just like I heard that, like with Uber, you know, I'm not an investor in Uber or anything, and I don't know Travis or anything, but I heard that was his third startup. And the first one was a total failure. The second one was an okay exit. And then he had his Uber. That's what I had heard. So it's not necessarily their first one.
So when you say, are they compelled to execute? How do you look at a person and tell that? That seems to be such a non-operational criteria. How do you find out by looking at a person whether that guy is passionate and will stick to it? Is he compelled to do it? That seems to be a difficult thing to estimate. How do you do that?
Yeah, some of it's kind of a gut feeling, but some of it's just some of the questions I might ask them about, you know, not necessarily even about the company, but about how they handle things growing up, how they address problems, things like that. Why are they building what they're building? What matters most to them and why? You know, what they do in their free time. And it seems like the people that are really compelled to do it are obsessed. And just even companies, you know, companies that I didn't invest in, just reading books and looking back at some of the best founders, they were just nuts that they were compelled. Just like I heard the story of Airbnb, how Chesky and them sold the cereal boxes to survive. I mean, that's just crazy stuff. So those are the kind of people I want to invest in, people like that. They're just relentless.
Relentless, obsessed. That's a fantastic criteria. I never heard that explained that way before.
Yeah, because the share guys, I don't understand anything about the hair business, you know anything about the hair business, but I could tell they definitely do, and they're just so obsessed and compelled to do it. Because I said to them, you know, this is going to be a hard sell because investors aren't going to understand this. And they're like, yeah, well, we understand it. We get it. This is what we're going to do. We're going to go city to city, literally, stop at all the barbershops, and they'll listen to us because Ty's a celebrity there. And, you know, we'll have these little kind of like classes or mentorship things, and they'll want to sign up for the app. And it's exactly what they're doing. They go city to city. I mean, it's just nuts. They're crazy. And, you know, they've been featured in Fast Company now and Black Entertainment. And they've been featured to speak at conferences and things like that. They're just nuts.
Got it. Well, that's fantastic, James. Thank you. Thank you from Kryptonites. For joining us. And I mean, this has been one of a kind of a podcast, and I'm sure our audiences are super excited. It'll be one of the raging success stories on our podcast, I have no doubt, because it's so ground level, so authentic, so real, and so exciting. So I wish you the very best, James, and I thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Knights. Never miss an episode. Subscribe now at www.cryptonights.io.